We are delighted to have Katie Woods from the law firm of Barney, McKenna, and Olmsted, who is a specialist in elder law, as well as many other aspects of the law. I went online and looked you up. She graduated from BYU, as well as the University of Missouri, Kansas City School of Law. She is licensed in Utah, Colorado, and Nevada, and certified in guardianship and elder care. She is going to do a PowerPoint presentation on the documents that we all should have completed to ensure that our wishes are carried out regarding our health care as well as our finances. Please ask your questions, and Chris has asked me to have you repeat their questions because they may not hear it with our sound system.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hey. Well, thank you for having me. Can everyone hear me with that? Okay. So it says up here that my name is Kristen K. Woods. My middle name is Kate, and so please feel free to call me Katie. That's what I go by. I grew up here in St. George, went to Dixie High School, which is where I graduated from. And about 2.5 years ago, I moved back to St. George after going to school and working and living in Las Vegas for a while. I came back to the best place in the world, and I'm happy to be back. So as was introduced, my specialty is elder law. And what that means is I do a lot of estate planning. I do a lot of planning for incapacity, which means planning for that moment while we're still alive, but we may need some help or assistance with our financial matters, healthcare matters, or things like that. And then once somebody does become incapacitated, I help the family with guardianship, conservatorship, those sorts of issues. So that's kind of where I focus my practice. I am an attorney, and I'm also a certified guardian, which means some people don't have family members around them that might step in to care for them when they become incapacitated. In those situations, I'm licensed and the court can appoint me to step in and help with those sorts of things. So I do own a guardianship company called Owl Guardianship and Elder Care Services. And whenever I have to serve in that capacity for somebody, that's when Owl gets involved, because that's not really a law firm thing. So in other words, I do this kind of stuff day in and day out. So if you have any questions, please let me know. I just want to touch a little bit on some of the things that you can do right now to plan for your incapacity. Hopefully that never comes, but it's good to have a plan in place in case that it does. A lot of times you'll hear lawyers speak about trusts, wills, estate planning type of things. Those are important tools, but quite frankly, when the trust and the will becomes important, we're already dead, right? It's just kind of a blunt way to put it, but at that point, you don't really care what's going on with your money. So my opinion is that more important than those documents are the documents that you can have in place now to plan for your incapacity, which is kind of going to be the focus of my talk today. I will touch a little bit about the trusts and the wills and those sorts of things, because it is important for your quality of life and your comfort to be able to know what's going to happen to your assets after you pass away. So we will touch on some of those things. So when you hear the word estate planning, some of the keywords that come into mind, I don't want to block anyone's view. Trust, will, joint tenancy, you know, deeds, powers of attorney, those sorts of kind of terms come into mind. So let's talk about the differences. As I just said, trust and a will are things that are important once you pass away. Powers of attorney, joint tenancy, health care directives, those are some things that are important while you're still alive but may become incapacitated. I was going to play a clip. We don't have any sound, unfortunately, but I was going to play a clip from a show called Keeping Up Appearances. Has anyone seen that show? So that's my grandmother's favorite show, and we watch that. We've probably seen each episode about 10 times by now. It's awesome. But if for those of you that are familiar with that show, you know that there is a character on the show called Daddy. And Daddy is he's probably in his 90s. He's the father of a lot of the daughters that are the central theme of the show. And he's got some dementia-type issues going on. He thinks that he's still back in the war. He frequently marches up and down the street in his uniform. A lot of times he goes, riding his bike naked down the street, those sorts of things. This was a clip showing when Daddy steals a car, and they have to kind of chase him down. And it is kind of, making light of those serious situations when somebody does start losing the capacity, but Daddy in this show is not really somebody that's going to be capable of handling his finances, paying his utility bills, filing his tax returns, doing the kind of day-to-day things that you need to do, speaking to the doctors, making important healthcare decisions. He's not somebody that's going to be in that kind of condition to make wise decisions. So he would be somebody that would have benefited, I don't know, they don't talk about this in the show, but from having a healthcare directive in place or a power of attorney in place that he executed before he became incapacitated, so that he himself made the decision of who he wanted to help him out with those financial matters, those healthcare matters, once he became incapacitated. That's one way that Daddy can stay in control of his life once he's kind of lost control of his mental faculties. Okay, so for all of us, one way to think about it is, if I, I can't maybe do these day-to-day things anymore, who do I want to step in and do that? Maybe you have some children, that one child might be better at financial decisions than another child. So if you didn't execute a power of attorney for finances, your children would all have the equal priority to step in and help you. You might not want that. You might want to particularly say, I want John, or I want, whoever, to be the one to help me with my finances. For one thing, that keeps you in control of that. For the second thing, it kind of stops any potential family fight about who's going to do that. Same thing with healthcare decisions. Somebody might be, one of your children or your family members might be somebody that you don't want to make healthcare decisions for you. Well, if you don't make that election while you can, then that might give somebody that you don't want to have that authority over you that authority. The other reason why this sort of planning is important is the cost of financial exploitation against elderly adults has gone up substantially. I just want to touch on some of the figures that the Utah Division of Aging and Adult Services put out in their report. They did a very comprehensive study of Utah-specific cases in 2010, and here are some of their findings. What they did was they reviewed, they went to the Adult Protective Services. They looked at all of the cases that had been filed in that agency about financial exploitation of an elderly person. And they looked at all of those figures for the year of 2010, and here's what they found. That article is in full available online, so if you want to write down that title and read the whole thing, it's very informative. In 2010 alone, in the 80 reported and supported cases in Utah, $7.7 million was lost due to a direct theft of seniors' assets. So think about that. That was 80 cases in Utah that were supported cases, and the state found that $7.7 million was directly taken from seniors. I mean, that's a pretty big figure. The average loss per case was $96,000. So the average loss per case involving a senior with dementia was $128,000. So you can see that jump. Even senior citizens who weren't incapacitated were being exploited, but those who did have that incapacity jumped significantly in how much was actually taken from them. Let's see. We'll touch right here. So it does, there are, the study did say that most of the exploitation was being done by family members, unfortunately. There are instances where friends, neighbors, people who have kind of finagled their way into a position of trust with that person also did the exploiting, but family members are the perpetrators in more than half of the cases. Okay. The average age of the victims was 79. The average age of the perpetrator was 41. The average loss per case when a child of the victim was a perpetrator was $157,000, which was more than any other category. So unfortunately, what that means is the family member perpetrators were far more comfortable with taking money than the other perpetrators were. National studies suggest that for every one case that was reported, between 10 and 44 cases go unreported. So this study is most likely underestimating the impact of exploitation. The range of total loss due to elder exploitation is between $77 million and $339 million per year. So it's not a small problem, and in fact, again, that's probably an underestimation of what's actually happening. So what are some of the things that you can do now to maybe protect yourself or a family member or, you know, somebody you care about from this exploitation? Well, like I touched on before, there are some things that you can do now to keep yourself in control once you lose your capacity. By selecting the people that you trust, that you don't believe would, you know, exploit you, by putting those security measures in place before you actually become incapacitated, can save you a lot of money, a lot of heartache, and potentially a lot of litigation. First thing is a healthcare power of attorney. In Utah, that's called the Utah Advanced Healthcare Directive. And I have brought a copy, a blank copy of this for each of you to take if you'd like. It's a 4-page document. What it does is it goes through and asks for your name and contact information. It asks for your name and contact information for your agents. So you can put down, I want so-and-so to be the person to talk to my healthcare providers at any time that I am unable to do so. Now, the hospital here in town, the IHC, does a good service to the community by allowing you to take your Utah healthcare directive to the hospital. They will actually scan it into their system so that if you show up at the hospital after an accident or something like that, they know who to call. So you'll have the phone number of your agent, you'll have the address of your agent, and then they know who to contact in the case of an emergency. You can name an alternate agent. So if you, if this person's not available, you might name your spouse as your agent. Well, if you and your spouse are in a car accident together, you might need to have an alternate agent listed so that, you know, somebody else can help you out. The healthcare directive goes on, and it asks you some specific questions about your wishes, which are important because if you don't have this filled out, your family member is going to be able to do whatever they think is best, which might conflict with what you think is best. It asks you to nominate a guardian. Who's familiar with guardianship, the term guardian? So let me touch on that for just a second. The difference between a guardian and a healthcare agent is that the guardian is court-appointed to care for you, typically in a long-term situation. So the healthcare directive and power of attorney is very helpful for those kind of emergency situations, who's going to help you out. But if you've got a debilitating condition like dementia, Alzheimer's, a brain injury, something that's going to have you be alive for a significant period of time but still need help, a guardianship is something that you will need because that person is going to have to do things, not just talking to doctors at hospitals. They're going to have to help you out at Social Security office and, you know, banks and lots of different places that know how easy it is to forge a healthcare directive, and so they want something more. So guardianship is something that is court-ordered and court-appointed, okay? So this document allows you to appoint your guardian. Now, that's important because if you do need long-term care like that, that's going to be somebody who's going to be helping you every single day, making very important decisions for you. So it's important for you to be able to select who you want that to be and not just leave that to chance or, you know, have your family members fighting about that. Okay, yeah? You can, so there's a nomination of guardian, who you want to be your guardian, on this form. And then that person can take this document to the court and say, I've been nominated to be so-and-so's guardian, and then the court will issue an order. And once they have that court order, that person is going to be able to do everything for you, everything you need. Because a lot of, you'll discover a lot of institutions, agencies, banks don't take powers of attorney. Some of you might have already experienced that with family members of your own. Sometimes they want that court order. So if you do need a guardian, you can appoint one on your directive. Okay? Yeah?
Can it be the same person?
I'm sorry, I didn't repeat that question the first time. She said, can it be the same person? Yes. Yes. So can the healthcare agent be the guardian as well? Yes. And a lot of times that is true. I would say in 85% of the clients that I help set this up, that's the case. Yes?
Is there any difference really that trustee in your trust also taking care of if they're trustee, they would be appointed to do all the time? And what's the difference if we fill that out versus having our trustee knowing our wishes, which takes precedence?
Okay, so the question is, basically, is the trustee in a position to do this for you? What's the difference between a trustee and a guardian or an agent? The answer is the trustee is only has authority over assets that belong to the trust. So the trustee is really a financial fiduciary. When you're talking about a healthcare agent, you're talking about somebody who has authority over you, your person, your healthcare, which is a totally kind of different subject matter than the trustee. It's true if you have a trust set up and you've got a trustee involved, there are going to be paragraphs in that trust that talk about what happens if you, the original trustee, become incapacitated. Your successor trustee can step in and manage those trust assets, but that's it. There's really nothing in that trust that gives that trustee the authority to do your healthcare decisions or anything like that. Does that answer your question? So it is important when you go to see an attorney to do your estate plan, make sure that you're not walking out of that door with just a trust, with just a will, that you're also walking out the door with powers of attorney, with healthcare directives, because they're very different roles. Any other questions at this point? Yeah. The guardianship is going, as long as it's a full guardianship, and there are limited guardianships you can get for specific reasons, but we'll talk about a full guardianship, is always going to trump a power of attorney nomination, because it is a court-ordered, court-sanctioned authority, and the statutes of the state of Utah lay out that the guardian gets to do whatever, basically steps into your shoes, does whatever you could do, and so that usurps the power of that agent. So so you're filling out these powers of attorney in the case that you need a guardian later. Those are tools that your agents take to court and get that guardianship. Okay? So you're making those nominations and you're choosing the people who can go to court and do that if you have one of these. The document goes on to ask questions like, do you want your agent to be able to consent to your participation in medical research? It asks you if you want to be an organ donor, some of these important questions that you might want to make the selection and not leave up to someone else. The third page is the page that talks about your end-of-life decisions. Do you want to be on machines? Do you want to make a selection at all? You can say, no, I leave that completely up to my agent. Do you want to be taken off of the machines? There are different categories here that asks you, If you want to be taken off machines, do you want to be taken off in certain circumstances, like I have a progressive illness that will cause death, I'm close to death and unlikely to recover, and et cetera. So it gets pretty specific there. But that, again, gives you a little bit more control about what happens to you when you may be incapacitated. Okay? All right. So feel free to pick up a healthcare directive. I suggest each of you have one of these in place. I have one of these in place. It's just good to have in case of an emergency. All right, so any questions on the healthcare power of attorney? Yes, they're just right up here at the table. Yeah, so feel free to pick one up afterwards. All right, the second tool I want to talk about is the financial power of attorney. So these, are two separate documents. You can give, so the financial power of attorney is the authority you're giving someone to do your financial things like pay your bills, go to the bank, file your taxes, participate in litigation for you, sell your car, you know, whatever you would do while you had your capacity. You're giving someone that authority. So you can give the same person your healthcare decisions and your financial decisions, or you might think, you know, somebody else might be better off at the financial side, somebody else might be better at the healthcare side. So those are split up, okay? And you want to make sure that you do have two separate documents, because, again, that Utah healthcare directive is something that was set up by the Utah legislature. So all of the doctors are familiar with that form. So if you have one kind of mashed up document with financial stuff and healthcare stuff in it, probably is not going to be very helpful when the doctors reject it. Okay, so I would suggest you make sure you've got the two separate forms. This is also a document that where you can appoint a conservator. A conservator is kind of the same thing as a guardian, but financial-wise. Okay, so it's a court-appointed position. So when you need that long-term care, someone can go to court and become your conservator. Okay, again, this is a way for you to nominate someone for that long-term care and remain in control and protect your assets. The third tool I want to touch on is a special needs trust. This is something that can be set up to help someone who is going to have a long-term disability still receive government benefits and not be disqualified by their assets, okay? It's a little bit technical, but where this becomes the most helpful is if you have a child with a disability and you're worried that you're leaving your child an inheritance that is going to disqualify them from the government benefits they're receiving. For example, let's say you have a Down syndrome child. That child might be receiving lots of government benefits that give them some participation in day school, some housing benefits, living in a group home, receiving some SSI income. Now, if you pass away and your child suddenly receives $100,000 in inheritance, now your child really doesn't qualify for those government programs, okay? So that's another thing to be aware of if you have that circumstance in your family, is you probably would want to go talk to an attorney and get a special needs trust set up, okay? The person that is going to be the beneficiary of that special needs trust has to be younger than 65. So that is one caveat to be aware of. Okay? Any questions about that?
If you were to give some of your money to a grandchild who is disabled, is it healthy to give it directly to him or put it in guardianship or a trust?
So the question is, if you have a grandchild with a disability, what's the best way to give them an inheritance? The answer is through a special needs trust. Because what that basically is you are appointing a trustee to manage that money for that incapacitated person, to give them money whenever they need help with, you know, going on a trip, getting some personal care, getting some, you know, haircuts, you know, things that the government doesn't pay for. And so that would be the proper way to give that to a disabled grandchild if you didn't want to disqualify that grandchild from government assistance. And you can build that into your typical family trust. It doesn't have to be an additional trust. What your trust would say is, and to our grandchild, Timmy, we want Timmy's share to be distributed through a special needs trust. And that, then the trustee has specific authority to go and do that. Okay?
And the trustee would be the same as the one who's taking care of your trust.
So the question is, can the trustee of your family trust be the same as the special needs trust trustee? The answer is yes, but it doesn't have to be. You can say in that trust document, I want so-and-so to be the trustee of this trust, and so on. Was there another question? Yeah. No, age 65 is the guideline set up by the federal programs that say we'll go along with this as long as somebody is under the age of 65. So that's kind of the arbitrary age that's been put into the law.
So as long as they're put on before 65?
As long as the trust is created and funded before they're 65. So this is not really a trust that's meant to support senior citizens, really is a vehicle to support younger disabled persons through their life. Yeah. But it is, I put this in the presentation because I find that it's something that not a lot of people are aware of, and a lot of people do have disabled family members that they're planning on giving funds to. So I just like to spread that knowledge that that is a tool that you might want to consider using if you're going to do that. Okay? All right. We already talked about guardianship and conservatorship, but each state has a different variation of this wherever someone lives. In Nevada, there is no conservatorship. It's called guardian of the estate. They're different vocabulary, but same things. Court-appointed people, they're most ideal for long-term situations, and that court order will allow that guardian or conservator to protect assets. I'll give you an example of a situation where somebody should have set up a guardianship but didn't, and something kind of disastrous occurred. So I have a client whose mother has Alzheimer's, and so the daughter moved the mother to a house right next door to her, and for several years they lived that way with the daughter just, you know, keeping a close eye on mom. Mom was able to continue to live independently. Was doing some pretty bizarre things, like writing love letters to her pastor, and things like that. and I have copies of those letters in my file, and they're pretty funny. And, you know, just kind of making some bizarre phone calls and calling the police all the time and talking about, you know, aliens in her backyard and things like that. But the daughter was like, okay, you know, that's harmless. I'm able to keep an eye on mom, so I'm good. Well, unbeknownst to the daughter, mom called up a piano dealership after seeing a coupon in the newspaper and bought, sight unseen, over the phone. I don't know why the piano company decided this was a good idea because we've now sued them, but bought a baby grand piano for $25,000 over the phone, transferred money, was able to get the money transferred, and now we've been in litigation about that for the last 8 months, probably have 8 more months to go. If daughter had made the decision to get a guardianship in place, we could have had that overturned immediately because we would have had proof on the record already that mom was incapacitated instead of having to go to court to prove that mom's incapacitated and unwind that transaction. So that's just one kind of example, a real-life example that I'm helping a client deal with now about the importance of a guardianship or conservatorship. Okay? So if you are in a situation with a spouse, with a family member, who is in a long-term incapacity situation, you definitely, definitely, definitely want to get a guardianship appointed. Okay? Questions about guardianship, conservatorship? Yeah?
Not so much that as if we set this stuff up here for Utah and we move, how much difference from state to state are we going to have to redo this each time we move to a different state?
No, each state has a transfer statute that says if you move, this is what you do to get the guardianship transferred to the new state. So you do need to get that re-registered or transferred in the new state, but it's not difficult. Yeah, once you have it set up, you know, that's kind of the key, is get it set up, and then everything else is just kind of fine details. So the question was, how much difference between states if you move? Is it going to be a lot of trouble to keep the guardianship? It's not. Okay, yeah?
You know, when you talk about financial exploitation of seniors, was any of that done by people with authority to take funds and do it?
You know, the question was, back to the exploitation, were any of the exploitation done by professionals, like maybe financial advisors, conservators? The report didn't go into detail about that. However, I will say, when you have a conservatorship, every single year you have to file an accounting with the court. You give bank statements, you give an accounting. So it would surprise me if a big percentage of that was done by conservators. I could see more like financial advisors maybe being in a position of doing that because they don't have a reporting obligation. But with the conservatorship, it's pretty... That's why it's kind of a good, safe way to go, because there is that accountability to the court. Every year they have to show what's happened to your money. And so it would be kind of difficult to do that without being caught. Not saying it hasn't happened before, but the report didn't go into that. Interestingly enough, though, the report did suggest that when they looked at these cases, the people that were being exploited did have a relationship with a doctor, a lawyer, a financial advisor, and what the report suggested was if those professionals would have reported their suspicions or stepped in before the exploitation got so far, it would have cut back that number of total exploitation by over half, they said. So the takeaway for professionals like myself or other, you know, people that are working with elderly, you know, senior citizens or disabled people, is if you see something, say something, right? We have the Adult Protective Services, you know, number that, you know, you can call, and then that triggers an investigation. So, you know, if you're seeing something like that going on in with your friends, family members, I mean, the report did say if people would have stepped in a little sooner here, it would have helped a lot. Okay. Any other questions? So here are some planning tips. Yeah, go ahead.
We have a power of attorney and will and all this kind of stuff in North Dakota. Who do we go to in Utah to make sure it's all right? You said they needed to have it checked state by state.
Oh, okay. The question is, if you have established a trust or a will or these documents in a different state and now you live in Utah, where should you go to get that stuff updated? His question was particularly pertaining to a guardianship, but you're talking about your estate planning documents. You can go to any estate planning attorney. You know, you come to me, you come to anyone else in town. There are a lot of good practitioners in town that can help you with that. Particularly, your trust and your will are probably going to be fine. It's good to have that updated with your new residence and things like that. If you need to make a change to your trustee, you know, that's a great time to go in and get everything changed. But particularly, your powers of attorney and healthcare directives should be updated to the new state's law. Because if you're living in Utah, you go to the hospital in Utah, they look at a North Dakota form. They're probably not... They're going to be suspicious. We don't want doctors to be suspicious. That's just not a good thing because they just throw the document away. So it's good to have that updated Utah power of attorney. Yeah?
When you go into seeing an estate planning attorney, what should you bring with you?
Okay. Question is, when you go in to see an estate planning attorney, what should you bring with you? If you have documents that you've already created, for sure bring those in. If you've already got a trust or will or powers of attorney in place, bring those in so the attorney can look at them and tell you whether or not you need to make a change or if they're still good or, you know, whatnot. If you don't have anything in place, then really all you need to do is come in and have in your mind what your assets are or have a list of what your assets are. Do you own a home? Do you have retirement or pension benefits? You know, what sort of investment accounts do you have? The importance of knowing that stuff for an attorney is to be able to advise you on to how best to avoid probate with those assets, how best to get those passed on to who you want those to be passed on to. So that's really all, you know, all you need. If you don't have the documents, just come in with that property information. He or she is going to ask you about, you know, who do you want to be your trustee? Who do you want to be your power of attorney? So maybe start thinking about those things, about who you want in those positions of authority. And that's it. Was there another question? Okay. All right, some of the things that you can do to protect yourself is to plan early. Now, a couple of years ago, you know, I'll disclose my age to you guys. I'm 29, so I'm pretty young. I'm on the young side. And a couple of years ago, I was giving a presentation kind of like this and, you know, telling everybody how important it is to have these estate planning documents in place. And I realized I don't have these estate planning documents in place, right? Because everybody, you know, the mindset is it's only when we get older that we really need to start planning. Well, you know, I'm driving around out there in my Jeep. I could easily, you know, get in a car accident and be in a situation where I need somebody to help me out. So I do have those in place now. But it is important to plan early because it's not like one day we wake up and say, oh my gosh, I have dementia. I need to plan. You know, that doesn't happen. In fact, one of my poor, cute little clients, exactly. It just doesn't happen. One of my cute little clients, in fact, we didn't know anything was wrong until one day she opened the door without a shirt on. Didn't really understand why people were so shocked at that. Then we, you know, found out that took her to the doctor, and sure enough, she'd been dealing with some pretty severe dementia for a while. So, but of course, she doesn't believe she has it, right? I mean, so plan early. Get these things in place before you are in a crisis. Protect yourself. Don't worry about hurt feelings. Now, probably the biggest thing that I hear from clients that come in to see me are, you know, I have three kids. I really don't want one of them to feel left out. I don't, you know, I would want this person to be the one in charge of the money, but I really don't want these other two to feel left out, so I'm going to leave all three of them in charge. Well, if you're going to do that, you really don't even need the documents because they're already in charge of you under the law, right, once you lose your capacity. Don't worry about those hurt feelings. Get the person in place that you want in place. I mean, honestly, they're probably not going to have their feelings hurt. They're probably going to be relieved if they have the right intention, right? So protect yourself. Set up a system of accountability. If you are at all concerned that the person you're putting in charge may have the wrong intention, may, you know, be tempted to, you know, spend your money in Mesquite, you know, whatever, set up a system of accountability. You can always name a professional like your attorney, your accountant, as your trustee, as your co-trustee with your child. You can do things like that to if you need another set of eyes on that. So be aware that that's an option. You can not have your children be involved at all, not have your family members be involved at all. There are professionals out there that will do this for you. So if you really think that there's that accountability that needs to be had, you know, plan for that. Okay. And that's the last point I had up there, which was you can use a professional. If you are concerned about your family involvement, a good portion of my legal work is litigation with regards to trying to work out these family issues. You know, one brother complains that sister's been taking mom's money as the guardian. You know, we start fighting about stuff like that. So if you think there's even an inclination to that at all, maybe consider using a professional. Okay? Any questions? There's also a sheet up here that I've brought with me that are just some tips for estate planning that you might want to look over and get a copy of. Briefly, I'll just touch on the trust and the will aspect of things. The importance of the trust and the will are twofold. One, the most important part is to get your assets to who you want them to where that you want them to be, right? Second, understand that if you don't have a trust, your assets will go through probate, even if you have a will, okay? So even though the will get your assets to your children or your family members or your friends or whoever you want them to go to, they will have to go through probate unless you have a trust. Now, second step past that is if you have a trust, make sure your trust owns your property. Okay? So that's the step a lot of people forget. They go into the attorney, they leave with the trust, and they say, we're set, we're good. If your trust doesn't own anything, it won't function the way you need it. So if you set up a trust, what you should be looking for is, you know, is my home owned by my trust? That's the biggest thing, because that's a lot of people's most valuable asset. If it's not, then it has to go through probate, even if you have a trust, okay? Are my bank accounts owned by my trust? Are my bank accounts, is my trust the beneficiary of my investment accounts and pension and annuities and things like that? Okay, so those are some of the things maybe to think about for those of you who do have those documents in place. You know, go back and check the status of those assets. Yes? Okay, so question is, if you have investment accounts with Vanguard, 401ks, you know, with different companies, how do you have the trust own them? The answer is, a lot of times you can't have the trust own them because the companies won't let you. They have to be in an individual's name. But your trust can be your beneficiary. So once you pass away, you want your trustee to collect those funds. Yes, because if you have set, let's say you have your 401k that you set up 30 years ago, you may have put down your friend Jessica as your beneficiary way back then. Now you don't want that, but if you pass away, she's got the legal right to collect those funds, unless you change that. The other thing is, if you have your spouse named as your beneficiary, but your spouse predeceases you, you pass away without changing that to your trust, now your spouse's estate collects that those funds, and your spouse's estate has to go into probate to get rid of those funds.
So
you
can't do that.
Yeah, so... Oh, some pensions don't have death benefits. You're right. Yeah, so you want to check and see, you know, some pensions won't let you do that. If there is a death benefit, you want to make sure, if you have a trust, that it's going into that trust. Okay? Yes?
With your business as guardian, can you explain maybe what you do, maybe some fees that are involved, and what to look for, whether it's you or another company like that, for us to look at as a fallback?
Sure.
Sure.
So the question is, could I explain my guardianship company, what it does, maybe some fees involved and things like that? So my guardianship company was set up a year and a half ago because we were having several people come to the law firm and say, I don't have family members, or, you know, my spouse died, I'm alone, or, you know, my family members are in jail and I don't want anything to do with them. You know, when I die or when I become incapacitated, who do I name to do that? Now, when I practiced in Las Vegas, there are a lot of professional guardians in Las Vegas. So I thought, surely there would be some here in St. George. Well, there weren't. Everyone is based out of Salt Lake. And my personal opinion is you need to be close. If you're going to be a guardian, you need to be close by so you can go to the hospital. You can, you know, do things like that. So that's when I started the company. And so the typical, you know, request from people is, will you serve as my healthcare agent? Will you serve as my power of attorney? Will you serve as my trustee? So when I die, you know, I'm putting you in charge of distributing that out. The other side of things is, frequently I'm contacted by Adult Protective Services or the court itself, and they say, we've got this person, they need a guardian, they don't have family members, they're already incapacitated, we would like you to step in and do that. So the way that the fees work on in my company, it depends on what service I'm performing. If I'm performing a fiduciary service, like a trustee or a personal representative, typically that's going to be a percentage of the estate. And that's right now it's like 1.5%. We keep in step with what the banks are charging. So the way that I do it is if you name me in your documents, I don't charge you anything until I actually have to do something. So after you pass away, I have to step in, gather your assets, find your heirs, sell your house, you know, do whatever is needed. Then we collect our percentage at the end of the day. If it's a guardianship service, that can range widely because some people need more attention than others. If we help someone transition to an assisted living home, they're already being cared for. We do weekly visits, so we're always making sure that person is being cared for. We're in constant communication with, you know, their nurses and things like that. And so that's kept on an hourly fee. The services provided directly by me are billed at $140 an hour, but my staff does most of that work because we're not going to charge you $140 for me to take you to a doctor's appointment, okay? So my staff gets billed out at a much lower rate. But that's just an hourly type of deal, and we will adjust that depending on the size of the estate, what the person can afford and things like that. So does that answer your question? Okay. Any other questions? Yes. Stay alive? Yeah, that's good.
House contents and personal items, that doesn't come under anything, does it, as far as probate or?
So probate only becomes an issue with titled assets. So a house that's titled with the recorder's office, if it's owned by Katie Woods and I die, now the recorder's office has a house owned by a dead person. They don't want that. But they also don't know who to give it to, right? Because they could have 14 people come in with a will that purportedly gives it to them. So they're not going to just do that. They're waiting for that court order that says court or recorder's office, give this to this person because they've got the proper valid will. So that's same with bank accounts that are titled. Household belongings and furnishings are not going to be an issue in probate unless somebody makes it an issue by suing somebody over them. Right? So, but when you set up your estate plan, if you have a properly drafted trust, it's going to have an instruction in there that it is your wish that all of your property, including your tangible personal items, go according to the terms of the trust. Or whatever you'd like. If you want so-and-so to get the grandfather clock, you know, that can all be in there too. It is legal. What my advice would be is if there's any inkling of thought in your mind that there's somebody's going to fight about that, get it notarized. Because then if there's a court case that started or something, then somebody can't say, that's, you know, you forged her signature, that's not really her signature, then you've got that notary. But if there's not a fear of that in your family, then just sign a list. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, question was, how valid is an out-of-state will? The answer is very valid. The laws of trusts and wills have been around for hundreds of years, going back to Old England, right? And they haven't changed that much.
So if it only has one signature, or I understand the test, supposed to have two signatures, it still would be valid.
Well, so the question would then become, is there a dispute about the will? If there is a dispute, then somebody could argue that it's invalid. If there's no dispute, then your will is going to be fine.
Then you mentioned about a house being put in the trust. Mm-hmm. The trust owns the where does your house stand? Because many of us will land in assisted living places, and they're expensive. I know my friend in Maine right now is paying $7,000 a month care for her husband. If he goes into Alzheimer's care, it's $14,000 a month. Where does our house stand? I mean, if one goes to an assisted living, one is still living in the house.
You're talking about if you're a married couple?
Yeah.
So the question is, if you're a married couple, what happens to your house if one of you needs care? The answer in Utah is that the surviving, or the spouse, what do they call that? It's not surviving spouse. The well spouse, we'll just call it, who's living in the house is entitled to keep the house, keep a car, and keep up to $80,000 in liquid assets. Everything else has to be spent down for your care until that limit is reached, and then the government will start helping out with that. So does that answer your question? So the house can stay with your spouse.
Okay. What about now one spouse is gone and the other spouse is left?
Then your house will have to be spent, sold. And
it's not protected by being in the trust.
It's not going to be protected by being in the trust if you need government assistance with your living
How
expenses.
Can you protect
Well, it's very hard to do that. The question is, how can you protect your house if you're living in assisted living and you want to keep the house? Well, the answer is, if you can afford to pay for your assisted living without selling the house, then that's the most obvious way to keep the house, right? But unfortunately, if you're down to your last dollar and the only thing you have left is your house, you are going to be required to liquidate that to pay for your care until you have less than $2,000, and then the government will help. So the only way to protect your house is to start what's called a self-settled asset protection trust. Those are complicated trusts where you give authority to some other third party who manages your affairs for you. Really not a practical trust for people to have. There is a 10-year look-back period for the government. So if that trust was created and funded and you then become disabled 5 years later, doesn't count. You've got to be able to make it to 10 years or more. They're not, you know, really recommended because you do have to name a third party trustee. And so it's an expensive way to protect your house and you then have lost control of your asset. But that is one legal way you can do that in Utah. It's okay.
Would it be more advisable to put your house in the trust or leave out of the trust?
Well, if you're going to, it should always be in the trust because you never know when you're going to go, right? So if you pass away and that house is outside the trust, automatically needs a probate. If it's in the trust, it will avoid that probate for your heirs. Okay?
If your house and car are in the trust, survivor, at any point, can you sell that house or car?
So the question is, if your house and car are already in a trust, you're single, can you sell that house and car? Answer is yes, because in a typical trust setup, when you set up a trust, you yourself are the trustee. You retain all power over your assets. You can sell things, you can give them away, you can burn them down, whatever you want, you can do. So you don't lose that power. Unless you do that more advanced trust I was talking about, that is really not typical. Does that answer your question? Okay.
On your assets, then, is there only a 5-year look back or a 10-year look back? Because it used to be 3 and then they moved it to 5. So if you were thinking you were going to have to go in to a nursing home and you got rid of most of your assets for 5 years prior and you were able to pay for your
It's a 5-year look back period for your personal assets. The 10-year look back period is only with regards to the self-settled asset protection trust.
Okay.
Yeah.
State taxes in Utah, I don't know if Utah has an estate tax.
The question is, does Utah have an estate tax? The answer is no. Some states do have estate taxes. The federal tax exemption right now is about $5.3 million. So if you have more than $5.3 million, you do need to plan for the taxes. What'd you say? You don't live here if you have $5 million. I know. It'd be a good problem to have, right? It used to be, at one point, that dropped as low as $100,000. And that was very serious for a lot of people. But they raised that back up to 5.27 or something million. So, did you have a question?
How do you deed your house to the trust?
Yeah.
You have to
get your house
Yeah, so when I do an estate plan, a trust package for people, we always include a deed with that. We deed any real property into that trust. It's just a quick claim deed from Joe and Joanna to Joe and Joanna as trustee. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some 15 years ago, McKenna put together a trust and a will. I assume that maybe we have to check that.
So question is, you did a trust in Utah 15 years ago. Should we have that rechecked? And if we move, should we get that updated? Answer is, unless you need to make changes to your terms of your trust, who your heirs are, who your trustee is, your trust itself is probably just fine. Like I say, for hundreds of years, the trust law hasn't really changed. But your healthcare documents, this healthcare directive was passed by the legislature in 2008. So that's all changed. And so those are the types of things, those powers of attorney, especially the healthcare documents, are things that you probably every 5 years should go get updated. It's probably because the form didn't exist 15 years ago. So you that might be a good thing to go in and get checked with them. So any other questions? Oh, my card. I will put my card. I brought cards. If you pick up this sheet, I've got my information down here in the corner. So if you do have other questions, you need your documents looked at, I always do free consultations, so feel free to call me. I'm happy to sit with you and discuss. My main thing is I want people to be educated about this before it's too late, before you become, incapacitated. We all hope that that day never comes. And for some people, like my great-grandfather, who died last year at 103 years old, he kept his wits about him till the very end. So maybe that, but the planning part is the important part. Not only does that protect you once you are incapacitated, but it does give you kind of that peace of mind. And so that's what I like to kind of help people do. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you recover. You're starting at square one again for finance?
Unfortunately, yeah. That would be kind of a tragic situation. Yeah.
Our son's guy died and stuff like that, so we advise him to go ahead.
So he has no life insurance. They won't let him do that. Yeah.
No really family except us and his brother,
Yeah. Yep, unfortunately, that's correct. Well, okay, if there's no more questions, then that's all I have. Thank you for letting me come.
You know, we all say, Katie, and please, can you just pass out these documents?